Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra is said to be the foundation or source scripture for what's called the mind-only school, Chittamatra or Yogacara school of Buddhism. So when looking into the mind-only school, I think this is a good place to start. It's the main source for these intricate and challenging teachings. So I hope this will be a fun but challenging and insightful class, and I hope it can help us in our daily practice in life. And let's keep bringing it back to that, as always, as we start to get into all the gnarly details of this system of Buddhist thought. I thought just first of all, I just happened to be reading this recently, and it's not a Yogacara text, it's by Torei Zenji, the disciple of Hakuin, the great reviver of the Rinzai Zen school in Japan in 1700s or so. But he's just talking about sutra study in Zen. Because sometimes classical Zen, they maybe wouldn't get into this kind of a class on all these technical aspects coming from the sutra. So if you might be one of those people who doubt this kind of process, he says here, in the present time, which was 1700s, people often think that having no intellectual knowledge is Zen, and so they don't use scriptures, sutras, or treatises. Instead, they say, what's the need for sutras and treatises in the special transmission outside doctrine? So this is a name for the Zen tradition, is the special transmission outside of sutras. They still don't realize that when what is outside the doctrine is clear, what is in the doctrines doesn't interfere. But if what is outside doctrine does not admit what is in the doctrines, then what is outside the doctrine isn't true either. They could follow that. So if what's outside the sutras, the special transmission outside the sutras in Zen, if that is clear, then sutras don't interfere with that. Sutras don't disturb the mind outside the sutras. But if what is outside the sutras doesn't admit what is in the sutras, then what's outside the sutras isn't true either. Why? Because when a mirror is clear, it doesn't select what to reflect. If reflections don't appear, it means the mirror isn't clear. You're rejecting the images of objects because the dust covering the mirror. So, when our mind is free and clear, we don't mind hearing all these gnarly teachings and difficult discussions about anything, really. But then we'd say, well, why bother with this particular sutra or a sutra in general? And Torei says, if you're on the great way, you don't conceive this opinion, especially since there are very deep meanings in the sutras that can point out so many of our barriers of perception. It's only because our vision is not clear that we repudiate the golden words of the Buddha and cannot find out the hidden meanings in the sutras that are hard to unlock. Which is, interestingly, coincidentally, this is the sutra unlocking the deep mysteries. It's not a matter of making a religion of sutras and treatises, just of using sutras and treatises as revealing mirrors, using the teaching to reflect our own nature, and using our own nature to reflect the teachings. Both must be clearly comprehended. So that's a little disclaimer about having a Zen class. on sutras, which we, of course, we do all the time. But this is a particularly difficult sutra, and rewarding, I would say also, if we put in the energy to unravel it. The Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra. So if you go through this class series, maybe one thing is by the end you'll be able to say this title. Sandhi Nirmochana. And so Sandhi or Samdhi means something like thought or intention, generally in Sanskrit. Sanskrit words have all these different connotations. It's a very rich language. And as we present some of these key ideas of the mind-only school, I'll present the Sanskrit because I think it's good to, if we're, you know, immersed in these Buddhist teachings over time, to start to get the familiar with, you know, at least some of the basic Sanskrit words, because you'll see them appearing in all these different translations. And if we know the root word that's being translated in all these different ways, and also the roots of the words, like in English, the etymology helps to understand these sometimes very subtle concepts about all these different aspects of the mind. So anyway, Sandhi means something like thought or intention, and the Chinese translations often emphasize the aspects of like profound or secret or hidden or mystery, which is another connotation of the word Sandhi. And Nirmochana means something like Nirmochana. It's like explaining or unraveling, unlocking. So we could say it's the sutra explaining the thought or explaining the intention of the Buddha. Sometimes it's called that. Or we could call it the sutra unraveling the mysteries. Or revealing the profound. These would be different ways of talking about it. And that's what the sutra does. It explains the profound mysteries of emptiness and the workings of non-duality. It's quite different from, say, like the Lotus Sutra people have been studying recently. I think the reason this Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra never got so popular as, for example, the Lotus Sutra is it's pretty difficult, which is a good reason to have a class on it, because it's hard to read it on your own. The Lotus Sutra has these metaphors and they're very accessible, and even though it's also pointing to the deep profundity of reality, the style of its writing and the metaphors also help a lot for just the general people to understand. It's kind of where it's pointing. And then we have the Prajnaparamita Sutras that are based on emptiness, like the Heart Sutra. And they basically just negate everything we can come up with. That's what the Heart Sutra is doing, right? No eyes, no ears, no nose, so on. And there's large volumes of Prajnaparamita, and they're all basically negating our ideas about things. So this Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra arose in the world in probably around 300 AD, scholars would say, even though we also attribute it to the historical Buddha. It appeared in the world at this time, partly as a response to Prajnaparamita, which is the teachings of emptiness and ultimate truth. And this sutra is also teaches ultimate truth, particularly in the first four chapters, which we're not going to go over because it's too long. But true to its title, it's explaining the mysteries of emptiness in a way that Prajnaparamita, even though there's hundreds of volumes of these teachings, if you look through them, it never really explains very much. It's kind of like It's more like a faith-based thing. It's just saying there isn't any of this stuff, okay? There just really isn't. And then, but we might wonder, well, really? Just because you say so? And then they would say, yeah, I'm the Buddha teaching this. And it's all empty. But this sutra, the Buddha is very grandmotherly, kind. He lays it out for us. He explains this system that how and why things are empty and not what we think they are. And also, it's a response to the nihilistic tendencies of Prajnaparamita, that if people understand emptiness to be like there's nothing at all, which when you hear the Heart Sutra, it can sound that way. This sutra saves us from falling into that view, as we'll see in as we get into this. It is very, it makes this point about not deprecating the appearing, arising quality of aspect of the world. And I think that's in there in the Prajnaparamita, but it's usually in the name of emptying everything out. It doesn't emphasize the dependent arising aspect so much. And it's also so it's a kind of a response to Prajnaparamita explaining the intention of the Buddha's words, and it's also a response or kind of furthering revelation of Abhidharma, which is like Buddhist psychology. It's very much about the mind and how the mind works, and thus it's called the mind-only school. So it's, and these three chapters that we'll look at in this class, the first one is on particularly on the mind and consciousness, how that works, the kind of psychological basis, you could say, for understanding emptiness teachings. And then the second chapter is on the workings of the nature of reality in a more philosophical way, as opposed to the psychological way, maybe. And then the third chapter we'll look at is how these three kind of, they're called three characteristics of all phenomena, are actually the same as these three lacks of nature, these three kinds of emptiness. So in a way, even though this second chapter we'll look at is setting up the basis for reality and emptiness, then that very basis gets emptied out, you could say, in the chapter 7. So that's a little background. This sutra, as most sutras, most authentic sutras attributed to the Buddha, were written in India in Sanskrit. And we no longer have in the world, maybe someday it will be discovered, but no one's yet discovered the Sanskrit original. But we have Chinese and Tibetan translations, the two main Mahayana branches, which kind of proves that there was a Sanskrit, because weren't translated from each other. And they're quite similar. And wonderfully, we have English translations from both the Tibetan and the Chinese. Two from the Chinese, one from the Tibetan. So we have this Wisdom of Buddha is from the Tibetan. And it's thick because half of the book is in Tibetan. Each page has the Tibetan. So if you you can check. If anybody learns Tibetan, it's nice to be able to check. This is also nice because it has kind of extensive footnotes, quite detailed, and I think we'll maybe mainly go with this translation. You don't need to buy these books if you don't have them, because the chapters we're studying are just a couple pages, and I have copied handouts. One of the Chinese ones is called Buddhist Yoga by Thomas Cleary, and it's much smaller because there's no footnotes. And maybe easier to understand in some ways, but he's Thomas Cleary, if you know him, he does a lot of Zen translations. He likes to make up his own unconventional translations of words, and sometimes it's a little tough going. And the second Chinese one is from this Numata translation series. They're trying to translate the whole Chinese canon. And so it's part of this Tripitaka translation project.
Does the word samadhi relate to samadhi?
Samadhi? I don't think so, actually. Samadhi, different roots, yeah. Apparently the roots of samadhi are this Sanskrit da, which means like to connect or join, which is related to dharma. And in fact, I guess not samadhi in particular. I also have a reading list. Maybe I'll pass this out this time. And maybe because you might not continue with this, and you might forget to bring these, I will pass out all three chapters. Unless you'd like, if you want to read ahead, I mean, I have them all today. We have chapters 5, 6, and 7. But if you promise to bring them or return them, if you don't come back, I could. What do you think? Would you like to just receive the one chapter that we'll spend the next couple of weeks on, or would you like to have them all?
I want
them all. How about I'll pass out these two now, and after class, if you want them all, come up, and I'll give you for some people who want the other ones. But if you think you might forget to bring them, then take this one. So here's chapter 5. I hope there's enough copies. This is from the Tibetan John Powers. And then here's the reading list, if you like. So there's two different sheets. This reading list I put on the top, these three different quotes on mind only. This concept of mind only is found in the sutras, including this sutra is maybe the first source for this term, citta matra. Or actually, I think in this case, it's vijñapti matra, like mere concept. And so I put some of the root source quotes because we're not going to get into those chapters. And then the reading list is quite extensive. I put asterisks next to my favorites. And again, this is just no special reading required outside the chapter that we'll study, but if you want to get really into this, it's a very complex system, and I find it a lot of fun, and you'll find all these different, you know, translators and commentators have all different takes on it. So there's some that's on mind only in general, and I put a bunch of Zen mind only connections on there too. So that's kind of like for fun. And it has the three translations of the sutra. The Lankavatara Sutra is the other main source sutra for mind only teachings. And then,
what's the relationship with the Lankavatara and this one?
The Lankavatara seems to have arisen later in the world, and it became more connected with Zen, early Zen, like Bodhidharma supposedly brought the Lankavatara Sutra from India to China. So I think you find a lot of mind-only emphasis in early Zen teachings in China in particular. And Lankavatara has that Zen connection, so D.T. Suzuki translated it. Looking at it, you know, you might think, well, why don't we do a class on Lankavatara instead of this one because it's more connected with Zen? But if you look at the Lankavatara Sutra, it's really messy. It's like, it's not structured. When I look at it, I see it as somebody's kind of like cliff notes, or more like class notes on the Sandinirmochana Sutra. But like, and then they dropped them on the ground. Somebody picked them all up and like, they didn't have page numbers, and they just threw them all together. So it doesn't have a structure, whereas this sutra is beautifully designed. The more I study, it's like an overview of the whole Mahayana path, really, building on itself in this amazing way. It's even though they say it probably got collected over time, it still kind of builds on itself. And it has chapters on all of the main Mahayana teachings. So there's chapters on the six paramitas in great detail that if you ever want to study the six paramitas, I think I would recommend this sutra as like the main source. And on some of the later, teachings on valid cognition and ways of knowing that the Tibetans later got really into are in later chapters of this sutra. It also has all the standard emptiness teachings about the ultimate. And it has chapter 8 is the main source for Mahayana teachings on shamatha and vipassana, these two aspects of meditation practice in great detail. The chapter 8 of Sandhi Nimocana. Also, if you look at the Chinese, you see the chapter numbers don't match up. They combine chapters in different ways. But when I say chapter numbers, I'll refer to the Tibetan. So it's a really meditation-oriented sutra. And these chapters 5, 6, and 7 that we'll look at are really the core basis for what later became the mind-only school. And they seem to be a kind of a unit, these three. They all have the same kind of introduction that the other chapters don't have, so they go together as a little package in the middle of the sutra. And then, as you see on the reading list, it's like Asanga, Maitreya, and Asanga, sometimes said to be the same person, but Asanga is this living person, was really him and his brother, Vasubandhu, were the founders of what we call the mind-only school. And it looks like the stuff that they wrote, the treatises that they wrote, are almost all based on and commenting on the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra. Like if you know the 30 verses of Vasubandhu, it's basically, and then you look at the sutra, it follows the same order of the sutra and it picks up the same themes and just reworks them in a kind of new creative way, but it's really commentary, and they wrote their own commentaries on the sutra. They didn't really mention Lakavatara so much either. I think Lakavatara maybe appeared after their time. But they lived around the time the sutra appeared. So I kind of have this thought, like, they did, possibly even they wrote the sutra, that's one theory, and called it a sutra, because it's so similar to all the stuff that they're talking about. Or else it appeared and they're like, wow, this is amazing. Let's just like get totally into this sutra. And then this whole school formed around their inspiration. So, what else about background? It's nice to mention this way of practicing with teachings, especially like sutra-like teachings that you maybe heard before, but I think it's good to keep in mind these three kinds of wisdom, because this is the practical way of looking at how we study something in a kind of meditative context. So the first kind of wisdom is the wisdom from hearing, is prajna, wisdom, but from hearing, or we could say, in the old days, they didn't have so many written words. It was all oral traditions. Now we could say from hearing or reading, but words, dharma words, the wisdom arising from just hearing basic, like I understand what this is saying, which in a difficult sutra, it maybe takes a while for that wisdom to arise, to even know what it's trying to say. And this doesn't necessarily like free us from all our delusions. But it's a kind of wisdom, and all Buddhist systems acknowledge that this is kind of prajna from hearing Dharma teachings or reading, studying. And the second kind of wisdom is from reflecting on what we've heard or read. So it's like turning over in the mind. The first one's in Sanskrit, Shrutamaya, which means Shruta is like literally hearing, Shrutamaya Prajna, and then Chintamaya, which is Chinta is related to Chitta, like the mind, thinking, reflecting, Chintamaya Prajna. And that's, I think in a class like this, we're both hearing and we're discussing and reflecting, and I think it's great, we can bring up questions and doubts, and that's why, that's the second kind of wisdom, is like clarifying more and more what we've heard, to the point of like possibly getting to like a really complete conceptual understanding of what some teaching is about. And And that's maybe the extent of what we do in a class, but then that's not the whole story either. The third type is the wisdom from actually becoming the teaching or cultivating or meditating on. So it's called bhavana maya prajna. So bhavana is this great word that's used for like meditation practice in general, or cultivation. But it means, the word bhava means being or becoming. So actually, meditation is like becoming what we've heard and understood.
Like embodiment.
Embodiment, maybe you could say, yeah, embodiment. So that's when, like, you know, all this stuff's swimming around in our consciousness, and then it's like sitting zazen and letting it percolate in, and having a kind of experiential realization of what we've understood. And the transition between this kind of second and third is kind of hard to talk about. And maybe we can talk about that more as it goes on. What's that leap between conceptual understanding and like non-conceptual becoming? And in fact, this parts of the sutra we're studying are all about this point. They're all about conceptuality and non-conceptuality. So the sutra itself can help us see how to make that leap. So to just enter into the sutra a little bit here, a compilation of the three translations, so we can compare them. So this chapter 5, the first four chapters are basically on the conventional and ultimate truth and the difference between them. And a different bodhisattva introduces each chapter and asks questions to the Buddha. The Buddha is here called the Bhagavan, the Blessed One, or World Honored One. So, chapter 5 is called Questions of Vishalamati, which means it's a bodhisattva, vast intelligence. Vishalamati means vast intelligence. These are bodhisattvas we often haven't heard of, but the last two chapters are actually, the questioner is Avalokiteshvara and Manjushri, the last two chapters. But these are more obscure bodhisattvas. And I put in parentheses, I think, in the title that the Chinese sutra, instead of calling it the questions of these different bodhisattvas, it's more, the Chinese chapter headings are more descriptive. So the Chinese chapter is called the characteristics of mind, intellect, and consciousness, or mind, thought, and consciousness is the title of that chapter, of this chapter. So that's what it's on. This is going to be on the basically the eight consciousness system. That's the definitive system of the mind-only school. And this is the first time it appears in the world in a kind of somewhat rough form in the sutra. It doesn't lay it out like here's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So we can do that. So it begins. Also, before we begin, let me just say that my own connection with the sutra is it's a very dear place in my heart. My teacher, Tenzin Roshi, has been very into these mind-only teachings for a long, long time, and mainly presenting them through Vasubandhu's teachings. And I think these sutras were maybe translated around the time that he kind of discovered the Sandinirmochana Sutra. Wow, this is the basis for all this stuff in sutra form. So we started studying this and continued for, must have been like 15 years or so. Patrick was saying, was it the practice period of Thassa Haro?
Yeah, that was 11 years.
11 years ago. So I think it was even before that he started studying these central chapters, and then we go back to the beginning, and weekly meetings, and then all practice periods for many years were all on this sutra, so it just feels like really going through this myself. I feel this close connection to this, to the sutra and all the stuff that can be said about it. And so, and I haven't picked it up myself for several years, so it's a great joy to get into these piles of notes and sub-commentaries, and it's a lot of fun for me. So, here's the questions of Vishalamati. The Bodhisattva Vishalamati questioned the Bhagavan, the world-honored one, the Buddha. Bhagavan, when you say Bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness, Bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness. Bhagavan, just how are Bodhisattvas wise with respect to the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness? For what reason does the Tathagata designate a Bodhisattva as wise with respect to the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness? You can see these things are set up for memorization, so they repeat a lot. Another translation here, we'll get into these terms as it goes on, important words, mind, thought, and consciousness. Mind, intellect, and consciousness. It's pretty universal. So the Bhagavan replied to Bodhisattva Vishalamati, Vishalamati, you are involved in asking this in order to benefit many beings, to bring happiness to many beings. Out of sympathy for the world and for the sake of the welfare, benefit, and happiness of many beings, including gods and humans, your intention in questioning the Tathagata about this subject is good. It is good. Therefore, Vishalamati, listen well, and I will describe for you the way bodhisattvas are wise with respect to the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness. So this thing about you're asking this in order to benefit many beings, it's so good that you're asking this question. All three of these chapters that we're looking at all have the same response of the Buddha, and the other chapters don't. So it looks like these three are a little package. Or else they're just especially good questions, these three chapters. And I think it's kind of a neat point that actually this was this great bodhisattva that maybe he actually knew the answers even, but he was asking this in order to benefit many beings who were in the assembly at that time, and so that the sutra that got written down, we could read it later. If he didn't ask, even if he knew, we wouldn't have that benefit. So this is something to think about in a class when you're asking questions. Is even if, and I actually have many times have asked questions in class kind of with this in mind, like I kind of know, you know, how I would say it or kind of the answer, but I want sometimes I would like want my teacher to like you know, how would you say this, you know, or this sounds like, even though I know what you're driving at, this sounds confusing the way you're saying it, and like, can you, how would you say it in these terms, you know. Mm-hmm. You know, so for kind of so that other people can hear. So you're welcome to do that. So now the Buddha's going to answer. Vishalamati, whatever type of sentient being there may be in this cyclic existence, which is samsara, the whole world of experience of what we call life, everything we know is basically called samsara. Because nirvana, which is sometimes like the opposite, is like not something that we know of. It's not in the world of existence. And cyclic just means this is in the model of birth and death and rebirth and re-death. And cycling around, I think samsara means literally cyclic existence. So the Chinese, they say, actually say birth and death. So all sentient beings in samsara with its six kinds of beings, and these are, as you may know, these six realms. So there's, you know, from the bottom up, it's like the hell realms, the hungry ghost realms, the animal realm, the human realms, kind of right in the middle, the jealous gods, or the fighting gods, and then the god deva realm. So this is standard Buddhist cosmology going way, way back, the six realms, which you could say are like psychological states of mind of all of us, even though humans is one of them. You could say humans is when we're just kind of like going along neutral, we're just like a ordinary human, but then we fall into hell realms, and we fall into hungry ghost realms, and we fall into animal realm, and the fighting gods are like the ones who are like almost god realm, but they want to be complete god realm, so they're like trying, they're not quite satisfied, and they're trying to get a little bit higher up. So, and then the god realms, still in samsara in Buddhism, these devas, you know, they live for billions of eons, they're totally happy, it's a really great life, but it's impermanent, and all these six realms are created by karma, and when the karmic fruition is used up, they fall back into some other realm. So, he's just covering all the bases. All sentient beings in samsara, in these six realms, six kinds of beings, these sentient beings manifest a body and arise within states of birth, such as egg-born, womb-born, moisture-born, or spontaneously born. This is, again, just old Buddhist ways of birth. It's, again, just laying out the picture. All beings are in these six realms, and they're all born in one of these four ways that you see in various different sutras. Spontaneously born, I think moisture born is referring to like mosquitoes or insects. At least the way they understood it is they were like born from water. The bugs that are born like on water. They're really probably egg born too, right? But, and spontaneously maybe like in the like heavenly realms or something. Still, these are all samsaric.
I wonder if that would refer to, I was just watching a video on botany and mosses. He was talking about ferns, really, and how, you know, bryophytes and ferns had a really slow reproductive cycling until the angiosperms, the flowering plants, came around, which is a much quicker and more infinitely more complex way of reproducing.
Although we technically... we wouldn't say that plants are in the six realms. Mm. Mushrooms are kind of borderline, I guess. They're not quite sure whether they're a plant or an animal, huh? But, fungus. But in general, plants are living, but they're not sentient beings, according to Buddhist tradition. They have a kind of life energy, and they're highly respected as life, so there's monastic precepts about cutting down grass even because of the life in it. But it's still not considered a sentient being, and you can't be reborn as a plant. Plants?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not part of the animal realm. But things like, well, it doesn't have to be animal realm, because hungry ghosts are not actually animal realm, and hell beings aren't either. But they're sentient beings. I think the main thing about sentient beings is they have some primitive kind of mind, or, you know, scientifically we maybe say like a nervous system. And I think we shouldn't get into the discussion about nervous systems and plants, although it might come up in the mind-only class. But not now. primitive nervous system means like it responds to pain and pleasure, even in a very primitive form. Insects, I think, they try to escape pain and move towards pleasure. Amoeba, maybe not. I don't know if amoeba are sentient beings. So where the borderline gets drawn, and highly evolved plants. Like, what about a Venus flytrap? It seems like it's responding, but still, you know, there's the secret life of plants, right? But whether they have pain receptors or not, I think it's, the scientific word is not in yet, definitively.
And they're super responsive, whether
to light,
you call it, responding to pain.
To pain, yeah. So maybe we could say pain
super
is
responsive to their environment.
Some kind of primitive nervous system. You know, like worms, I think, have a central nervous cord, some kind of like a brain, primitive brain. So, yeah, plants seem a little, in a way you could say more highly evolved than animals, in that because they don't have this problem with pain that sentient beings have. That's very nice for them. So, anyway, this is covering all the bases of sentient beings.
Isn't this just, I mean, this is basically something taken on faith, right? I mean, talking about devas and, you know,
it's Buddhist cosmology.
Devas. So the cosmology has to be accepted because, I mean, I've never seen a hungry ghost. I mean, is the cosmology teaching that they actually have bodies?
I have been in this state of mind.
Well, yeah, states of mind. I understand them as states of mind, but
given
it's
a credit here, card in the right state of mind, one becomes a hungry ghost.
Is that what it means?
Well, I think there's different views within the Buddhist tradition.
I guess I'm asking
how literal. Well, this is just the Buddha Sutra. So the Buddha, the Buddha taught these six realms, and he didn't say, now you people should take me really literally here, and he didn't say these are metaphorical about metaphors for states of mind either. So therefore, later Buddhist tradition can either take them literally, some people do, or not. And I think he's just, it's kind of like, he's just saying, this is, you know, what I've taught. Take it however you want. And as we get into the sutra, you see the literal true states of existence. The sutra is going to actually start refuting all of them anyway. Mm-hmm. So everything becomes kind of metaphor in the end.
Don't get too attached.
But it's not really going to go into what, you know, it's just saying that, it's just reminding us that there's this whole realm of sentient beings that's not just our little human realm.
One thing they would seem all to have is the capability of making a decision.
Yeah, I think intention is a dharma.
So a plant might lean to the sun, but it won't necessarily. Yeah. It doesn't intend to do that.
In fact, I don't know if this is definitive or not. Could look into this, but offhand, I would say that all six sentient beings in these six realms have what we call five skandhas, but I'd say they all have at least four skandhas, because there's some deva beings in the god realm that don't have the form skandha, and which is like a physical body. Mm-hmm. So when you're saying do they physically exist, a lot of these realms of beings are more like their mind beings, or they have a maybe very subtle physical body, but not like we think of it. But the other four skandhas, like feeling, perception, and karmic formations,
so karmic,
is important in the sutra, you'll see in a minute, and consciousness. Now, what the worms have these four skandhas? Offhand, I'd kind of say, okay, yeah. I could see how a worm could have these four skandhas, and a fly. If you start getting smaller and smaller, it starts to look more dubious, but I would almost say that's the proposal here, because it's going to talk about this storehouse consciousness, and he's saying it's happening for all beings in all these six realms have this storehouse consciousness. Okay, so this is the setup. There's all these beings. Then initially, in dependence upon the two types of appropriation, I'll just read the paragraph first. The appropriation of the physical sense powers associated with the support, and the appropriation of predispositions which proliferate conventional designations with respect to signs, names, and concepts, the mind which has all seeds ripens. It develops, increases, and expands in its operations. That's all one sentence. So to break it down a little bit. Initially, meaning like at the start of a new life of a being, in dependence on these two types of appropriation. So the other translations say One of them says grasping. I think that's an easier word than appropriation. Maybe kind of a, appropriation is maybe kind of subtle grasping, but a holding or grasping. And in fact, it's it's the word adana. So we have in the 12-fold chain, upadana is the link that's called grasping.
Appropriation?
Appropriation is adana. So it's like a little less dramatic than upadana. But it's the adana because we're going to later see that it's the adana consciousness. So these two types of grasping, but this, as we'll see when we get into it, these are very subtle mental grasping. This is the process now of how birth of beings is going to happen. So the two types of grasping or appropriation is the appropriation of the physical sense powers associated with a support. So that's the five senses, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. And the sense powers, they're referring to the, you know, the actual like sense organs, sense like receptors, not exactly the consciousnesses, but like the eye organ, which, and all this is standard pre this sutra, you know, early like Abhidharma teachings of the Buddha, how the mind works, that there's an organ, a consciousness, and an object with each of the five senses. And the organ, we probably will get into this, so I mentioned now that, like, say, for the eye organ, we're not talking about the physical eyeball. In eye organ, all this stuff is like subtle mental stuff, so it's the eye organ is actually the kind of like the receptivity to light in the eye. But it's not actually like seeing, because that's the eye consciousness. And then the object is like color. We talked about this a little in Sashin for the people who are here, that like there aren't colors out there, that there's the receptivity to light and color, and then there's colors, and those two come together with what we call eye consciousness. The eye consciousness. And when those three meet, the organ, the sense organ, the sense object, and the sense consciousness, when those three meet together, you have an experience, a sense experience. And that's in early Buddhist teachings. But this sutra is going to take that model and kind of build on it. But the eye, and the ear organ is not the little moving eardrum in the ear, but it's you know, closely connected with that. That's where we could find it, but it's not a physical thing. The ear organ is like the receptivity to sound, we could say. And sound is like, you know, science would say it's like the waves in the air, as we've been talking about, but it's the object of sound. And when those two come together with an ear consciousness, you have an experience of hearing. And the consciousness is important because if you just have the receptivity to sound, but, you know, in a way, you need to be alive to have the receptivity, but you also need this, like, it's like the awareness of the sound. You were talking about direct sensory experience, but it's still, there's a consciousness, a sense consciousness involved. So, going back to this there's one of the two kinds of graspings, or appropriation, is grasping the physical sense powers, like holding them, appropriating them, using them, you know. Associated with the support just means with its object. So like the eye sense power associated with color as its support, because it needs that in order to actually operate. That's one of the graspings. And then the second one is the appropriation or grasping of predispositions, or, you know, karmic tendencies, you could say. One of the translations is habit energy. So, habit energy and propensity, is another word. So, predispositions which proliferate conventional designations. The proliferate means the habit energy that like continually keeps producing conventional designations, which is like words, like, you know, floor, watch, black, brown, white, all these
labels,
conventional designations is a fancy way of saying like labels and words. With respect to signs, names, and concepts. So all these things are going to get laid out much more as the sutra goes on, so I don't want to spend too much time right now. But it's basically the two types of grasping, we could say, are the... what's going to happen with them is... independence on these two types of grasping, the mind, which has all seeds, ripens. So this is referring to this, starting to paint the picture of this storehouse consciousness. The mind, independence upon grasping these the sensory world of operation, you know, the sense powers, that the mind grasps these five senses, and it also grasps this tendency, this inherited habitual tendency, and this is in a multiple lifetime model. So this is, we could say this is referring to the birth of a new sentient being. It doesn't say that, but you could say it's happening at any time, but in particular, at the birth of a being, there's this the formation, the conception of a new storehouse consciousness, and it starts developing immediately, holding, appropriating the senses, crucial thing for all sentient beings. The five senses are going to start coming to be, and it's going to, the other really important thing that's going to be grasped or appropriated is this predisposition, this habitual tendency. And before a being is born out of the womb, it has this habitual tendency, according to this story, for this tendency to proliferate conventional designations. It doesn't have any words or language. It's barely anything more than the mind. There's nothing even physical yet. But that's the proposal, is it? The first thing for a living being is this karmic tendency towards like grasping an external world as real. That's another way of
experience of dependent court rising, essentially.
It's kind of like a reification of dependent court rising.
Yeah.
It's kind of like labeling dependent court rising, and then by these words and designations, it starts to seem as if it's real. And of course, these insects don't have names. A pre-born insect is not going to have names. But it's saying there's something very, as I understand it, something very subtle in terms of this karmic disposition for even an insect to experience its world as an external world apart from mind. And this is a fancy way of talking about that. So the mind, which has all seeds is this term, bija, which is one of these mind-only terms that is referring to like karmic, it's a karmic seed, basically. It's like karma is any intentional action we do through body, speech, and mind. Every action we do according to this system creates and plants a seed in the mind. Every complete action of body, speech, and mind, intentional action. So like the heart beating is a bodily activity, but it's not karmic because we don't have to put any intention into doing that. But anything we do, even like an unconscious scratch, still subtly karmic. There's a little bit of intention to raise the hand up and scratch something, even if we don't notice that we're doing it. And then up to, you know, the most strong, and like, I am now going to squash this insect. You know, very conscious and intentional. And good and bad and neutral, all, you know, intentional activities. Continuously, every moment, we're like creating mental ones right now and bodily ones, or they're all being planted as what we call seeds. They're not, it's just a metaphor, seeds in this what's going to be called this storehouse consciousness. And it says based on these two types of grasping. So while we're alive too, it's like, it's because you could say there is a connection now here between seeing a labeled external world and karma. Intentional action is based on karmic activity is based on seeing a world of things that we're interacting with. So therefore, and the senses, our whole sensory world is like creates this me as a sensory apparatus and then the world. So it's like the whole way that thing works is like a setup for karma. These two, it's a kind of nice little story. These two types of appropriation are the basis for all this karma to happen.
So these seeds are like time release karma.
Time release?
Yeah.
That they, yeah.
Just over time, they'll have effects.
Yeah, that's why I think they chose the metaphor of a seed, because it's planted, but a seed of a plant, you know, later is a time release, comes, starts sprouting. Mm-hmm. And that's the image, is they're stored in this storehouse consciousness, and that they're, when their conditions are lined up just right, they come to fruition and manifest as more karmic activity in the world, which plants new seeds, which come to fruition, which creates a new situation, which plants new seeds. So it's a continually evolving. The seed metaphor is kind of nice in that way. That they're both, the seed is a fruition and a cause.
So the koan about the monk who was accused of impregnating the young girl, well, the monk's response is that so?
Mm-hmm. That was Hakuin, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of like this. Like all these different activities of mind that's going on are like seeds.
Yeah.
And they all come up. He's just kind of neutral in the whole thing.
Yeah, and is that so plants a seed too.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
still a karmic response. Okay. Yeah.
So this seems to imply that mind, it's, you know, mind appropriates.
Yeah.
So mind pre-exists seeds, mind accepts mind, mm-hmm. and mind appropriates five senses and mm-hmm. appropriates mm-hmm. These habitual tendencies and which proliferate conventional mm-hmm. reality, then we believe it. But mind, it sounds like in this idea, where does mind start?
So mind, citta, here, which is also going to be called the storehouse consciousness, is actually the same thing as the seeds. It's not like it's something that contains the seeds, which is why calling it a storehouse consciousness can be misleading. It's more like it is just the mere collection of seeds, of karmic seeds, which are, and they're seeds for sense consciousnesses, even. The sense consciousnesses are born from past karmic seeds of having sense consciousnesses, even. So that's maybe kind of tricky.
So I burned my hand pretty severely once, and this hand is now much more sensitive to heat
mm-hmm.
than the other one is.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of the seed of sense consciousness?
Yeah, yeah. It's a physical thing, and it was. Yeah, that's a nice example that mm-hmm. karma had to do with the burning. Mm-hmm. But even if it didn't, even just the fact that, like, our bodies, actually, according to the system, what we call our physical bodies, arise from this storehouse consciousness, mm-hmm. too. That's the source of everything. And it's not some thing, and I think as we keep going into this, let's keep remembering, it's not some, like, metaphysical self or source of or soul, or Buddha will say at the end of the chapter, I don't teach this storehouse consciousness to children for fear that they will take it as like the true self of everything comes out of. So it's a dangerous concept. So let's keep remembering that it's just the mere collection of everything that's ever happened. It's inconceivable by definition. It's not, you can't access it or like, oh, here, I am in a storehouse, look at all this stuff in here. It's, in a sense, it's individual in that each living sentient being has their own, you know, storehouse consciousness in a way, but because they're inconceivably arising and ceasing and not independent in any way, they're all completely interconnected too, which is why so from the kind of ultimate point of view, we could say like there's one mind, but I think from a more understanding the system, it's helpful to say that there's these individual but interactive consciousnesses, and therefore there can be even collective karma and things like this. So to continue,
So it would be convenient to still have a God and believe
in
I don't usually try to answer the question of where everything came from.
Yeah.
It would be inconsistent.
Or what's the source of the storehouse consciousness? You could say, well, in a way, this system is kind of its self-contained thing. It's saying it's just arising from past predispositions and doesn't tell the beginning story. So you could put a God in there at the beginning, like, boom, or a big bang at the beginning that set the whole thing in motion. But it doesn't go there just because it feels like we don't need to know that for how it works. But that's maybe a big discussion. But offhand, just right now, I would say, yeah, it wouldn't have to be inconsistent. And it's not the kind of gods that we're talking about in samsaric gods. We're talking about more like the source of all. But I think Buddha's pretty good about steering away from any non-experienced metaphysical kind of concepts. Although this mind-only system can sometimes get criticized as getting a little bit metaphysical or... this is sound, especially some of this stuff about the storehouse. But I think it's trying to be really like, it's just a psychological model of how our experience works. Yes?
Not to appear dense, but maybe so. So this paragraph that we're just finishing is talking about a particular mind which has all seeds of ripeness. Independence on the appropriation of these two types of appropriation. So this would be the beginning of a particular mind. Is this mind?
A particular mind. Mm-hmm. Mind. What we call a particular mind.
Arises upon appropriation.
Yeah.
Two types of appropriation.
Mm-hmm.
It ripens and then develops, increases, and expands. So it's kind of like...
in its operations. Like it's very simple in an embryo or something. And then, boom, then we have an adult human being, and it's like, whoa, way complicated.
So that implies there will be an end of this mind also at some point.
See, it sounds to me like in here, the mind pre-exists the appropriation.
Well, see, that's why I said this.
It's not the birth of a mind. Mind exists. It's just maybe a seed or whatever you want. I mean, it doesn't seem like birth here to me. Described. That's what I was getting at. So what would Nagarjuna say about this?
Something that begins and ends.
It does sound like that in the sutra, that it sounds like there's a mind, and then independence on these two kinds of grasping, it increases in operation. Yeah, but I think in general, in the later system, because we have all these Asanga and the founders commenting on the sutra, they do stuff that goes way beyond what the sutra does, actually. And in the general system, they would say, it's all going together. All of this is like the birth of a being is basically, the storehouse consciousness is partly taught to explain how rebirth can work. It's part of the origin for, so what's actually born, one moment of conception is, according to the system, is like, this very basic, alaya vijnana. But the main thing that it's storing, I'd say the thing is, it actually is storing these two kind of graspings. The moment that it's born in a new being, you could say. And it's also storing the past karmic seeds from the past being. So it's taught in order to explain, well, if we do something in this life, how does it affect the next life? That's part of the reason why they came up with this. The Buddha, I guess, came up with this idea of the storehouse consciousness. Because if you just have a fresh new consciousness born with no karmic dispositions from the past life, then how do you explain how karma in the three times, which is Dogen's way of saying karma. Karmic effects can happen in this life, next life, and the life after.
In a new birth, it's just a new arising, continuously existing pieces.
Yeah, it's not something.
I think of it as like Lego blocks. You put together a rocket ship out of Lego blocks. The Lego blocks already existed, and when you break it up to make something else, you still have all the constituent elements. They didn't disappear, and they didn't arise out of nothing. They're always there. It's just a new configuration.
Although they're not solid things either, and they don't last for more than a split moment, right? So here's another way of talking. You know, we're kind of leaping ahead into this Alaya topic, but Alaya is the storehouse consciousness, right? The word Himalaya. Hima means snow. So Himalaya is the storehouse of snow. So it's the storehouse or receptacle, container, consciousness. And here's one way of talking about the Alaya. It's nothing but the sum of the virtuous, unvirtuous, and neutral tendencies that make up the continuum of a sentient being.
Say that again?
Yeah, that's kind of a nice summary. Yeah. It's nothing but the sum of the virtuous, unvirtuous, and neutral tendencies, you know, karmic dispositions, habits, that make up the continuum of a sentient being. Mm. Continuum is a, you know, what looks like somebody who lives for 80 years. Yeah, which that gets used a lot in these languages because there's no self, no continuous self, but there's a karmic continuum of arising and ceasing in a particular pattern that we call like Kokyo or Sally. And so it's not like it's a container that's holding these things. It is just the sum. So that it's nice that it's not something, right? It's just the sum in the moment. It's constantly changing because our karmic activity is constantly influencing it in all different directions. But it's just the sum in any given moment of all these tendencies that make up the continuum of a sentient being. Not like a container different from its contents, but more like the constant flow of the water that is called a river. And the river image gets used both in the sutra and by Vasubandhu for Alaya. That it's like it's called a river, but it's actually just this flow. You can't get a hold of a river, right? It's a nice image. It's just a flow of continuously changing stuff, but we can call it, like when we look at it and label it, we can say that's a river. So we can look at this flow of inconceivable, ungraspable stuff that's constantly happening and call it a storehouse consciousness. But so we're just calling it that. We have to be careful about this. It's an ever-changing flow with no underlying entity. It's the sum of all conditions interacting. In other words, it's dependent co-arising. Right? But it's the dependent co-arising like of a particular continuum of a sentient being, because this is all dependent co-arising. And so but the way the inconceivable flux of dependent co-arising, which is, you know, everything is interdependently giving rise to everything else and everything ceasing and we can't get a hold of any of it, the way that is in this kind of individual way, you know, as a manner of speaking, is what we call this Alaya. So not exactly equated with dependent co-arising, right? Because then there would just be one Alaya. But it's like it's the dependent co-arising of a sentient being, could maybe say.
So I've been in my practice in all my life. During Sashin, I suggested that maybe the denial of dependent co-arising, denial of impermanence, is kind of an obstruction to this flow. Whenever I say, this is it, and I want to nail it down, I form an attachment. And that really is a denial of flow.
Mm.
It's an impediment to flow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's also part of the flow to do that. Although the two types of appropriation exist in the form realm, appropriation is not twofold in the formless realm. This is just making this little detail about this, these three realms called the desire realm, the form realm, and the formless realm, called the three realms. It's another encompassing of all of samsara. Sometimes say the six worlds and the three realms. So it's just another system. And it's just saying that in these formless realms, which are basically meditation realms, that are only, we basically are living in the desire realm continuously, and then form realm is basically deep concentration, absorption, jhana states are the form realm, and then even like deeper jhana states are the formless realm. So they're saying there's these realms, and the formless realm, as the name implies, there's no form. There's no form skanda. There's no body. It's a meditational realm where body is dropped off completely, and it's just there's life happening, but experientially there's no body or senses operating. It's like the senses are like turned completely off while still awake, something like that. Without going too far into it, it's just making this point that. It's a little like footnote that Buddha adds in, I feel like. It's just saying, in this formless realm, there's not the first type of appropriation because there's no physical sense powers. But it's making the nice point that even in this very, very refined, deep, deep, concentrated, almost non-dual meditation state, there's still the second type of grasping, which is these tendencies towards dualistic thought are still like, they're very almost dormant, you know, but they're still there even in the form realms, which is why like the eighth jhana, you know, these high form formless meditations are not liberation. They're very, very nice. They say that they're the highest worldly states of existence. In samsara, they're the greatest bliss, but they're samsara. They're impermanent, and basically still the seeds for suffering are still there.
So we have these five faculties that are aggregated by the sixth, which is the mind.
Mm-hmm.
The mind can look at itself. Is that what this formless part is?
You could say mind could look at itself. There's some debate, and within the school they'd get into topics like that, of course. But in another way, in fact, chapter 8, actually, the Bodhisattva Maitreya asks, can the mind look at itself? And I think the Buddha says, yeah, in this kind of way, that actually, that's what's happening all the time. Like, me seeing what I call jhani is really the mind looking at itself. So, I just want to, since we got the paper here, we can bring it again next time, but this at this point, we can look at these consciousnesses system. So we have the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and then we have here we have, you know, color, sound, etc. And then the way that they interact is like the eye consciousness, right? So you're always going to have consciousness. You're always going to have these three across like this, kind of like an organ, an object, and a consciousness. And the three are going to create the experience. So the five make a nice, neat system there. Then we have, but there's six, right? You have mind. And then we're going to have mind, consciousness. And in the early system, the Abhidharma system, the mind objects are called dharmas. So This is the 18 dhatu, the 18 realms, is the six, six, and six. This is early Buddhist teaching. And so the 18 realms, and here it's called the Dharma dhatu, the realm of dharmas. The dharma means, in this case, means phenomena. So, you know, a body perceives touch, but a mind perceives phenomena, mental phenomena. And then you have a mind organ, which is a kind of strange idea, and a mind consciousness. And the difference between those can get kind of tricky. But in this system, now in Yogacara, in mind only, it's not laid out this way exactly in the sutra, but this is how the system later developed it. Partly because the Dharma Dhatu is the world of phenomena. In the early system, it's like the things, mental and physical things of the world, but this is the mind-only school. So we're saying, what is all those dharmas in the world? What is the mind actually looking at? So here it says, Alaya, the storehouse consciousness, is the object of mental consciousness. So ear, nose, tongue, body. And so we have the eight consciousness system. So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 mind consciousness. And then they do this strange thing. They go, 7. The mental organ becomes the seventh consciousness, and the mental object, you could say, or Alaya, becomes the eighth consciousness.
Wait a minute.
Weird.
I was with you.
So you got up to here. You got the sixth consciousness.
Right, yeah.
That's the same of all Buddhist schools.
Yeah.
Now this system is going to mess with the mental organ that's called, in the early system, it would be like mano dhatu.
Mm-hmm.
This is mano vijnana dhatu. Mano dhatu now becomes what's called manas. Manas means like mind. Manas.
Right.
But it's the mental organ, but it's also, it's defiled. So it's usually called the klishta manas. So if you know that Sanskrit word klesha, klesha is like affliction or defilement. Some people say, I'm having a klesha attack. Going around Zen Center for a while, like I'm getting really angry or something. So related, klesha and klishta. Klishta manas is the defiled mind, mental organ, when they say thought or intellect, what are the secrets of mind, thought, and consciousness? This would be called thought, intellect, and it's also the mental organ. And so, in a way, you could say it's not really like a consciousness, but they're just saying it's so important here, and what it's afflicted by is a sense of self.
Mm.
So, and Vasubandhu says, particularly these four types of, it's afflicted by the belief in the self, or what it's like, self-view, self-love, self-pride, and self-grasping, or we can look at that later.
So
but it's
ego or personality?
Yeah, it's like the mind organ is become infiltrated with this view of duality, basically, of self and other.
Infiltrated. In this system, what's the difference between 6 and 7?
Yeah. We'll have to talk about that. But basically, this is basically just awareness. These are all like another word for consciousness is awareness. They're dualistic. Vijnana. This is a nice Sanskrit etymology. Jnana means knowing. Like, so prajna is like complete knowing, nya, which is also related to the English knowledge or gnosis.
Mm-hmm.
So prajna, jnana, which the system we'll get into is like a non-dual knowing, jnana. or like in Tibetan, yeshe. So vi means like the English word divide. So vijnana is like split knowing or divided knowing. So it's like you take a non-dual knowing and put a vi in front of it, and you get like dualistic knowing. So vijnana or consciousness.
Can you spell vijnana?
V-I-J-N-A-N-A. Is like a split knowing. So it's basically, this is like a somewhat dualistic, could be quite subtly dualistic consciousness or awareness of the activity of what's going on in Alaya that we think is like an external world. And the one who's thinking that is like this mind that's like making everything appear like dualistically or external.
So that's the delusion generator?
Yeah, it's like this is the culprit. And eventually you can have a mind, an unafflicted mind, but it's usually connected with, this is where the affliction comes in. So we can get into how this works more at the system. As you can see, this mind-only thing, it's a system. It's very like systematic, which is nice because you can really like get into it and talk about it and it tries to cover all the bases. But it's pretty elaborate system as you start to get into it too, and it can bring up a lot of questions. But I think it's an amazing, people put a lot of effort into like trying to make the system really as flawless as possible. So we can check that out and see if we can find the flaws in it and break it apart.
One paragraph. Wow.
Yeah. It's maybe going to be hard to do these three chapters. So thank you for coming. And if you want to have copies of the next two chapters, you can just come up and get them after. We dedicate any merit arising from this discussion to the realization of mere concept for all sentient beings in the six realms. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Illusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.